I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. My guest today is Rebecca Eccles. Owner of the luxury clothing boutique Prefontaine, Rebecca has weathered the storm of shifting trends and tastes since she opened in 2004. We discuss the evolution of the retail industry in the past 15 years and how she stays relevant for today's online shopper. But first, it's the Residential Recap with Austin Hooper. I'm now joined in studio by Austin Hooper for the Residential Recap. Hooper is our residential real estate expert, telling us what's happening in the markets. How's the year been treating you, Hoop?
So far, so good. Finally back into normal life rhythms. For about 3 or 4 weeks there, a Sunday felt like a Thursday and a Friday felt like a Monday. So got the ball rolling again, though, and starting to settle into some more routines.
So what are the buyer and seller attitudes in January of any year, and particularly this year? I know we're still in the midst of a government shutdown. Is that affecting any attitudes?
Attitudes, maybe not so much. On the process side of things, we might start to see the shutdown affect things. You know, I was talking to a lender friend of mine, John Snyder, with SWBC here in town, and the other government shutdowns that we've had recently that have only lasted a few days or maybe a week or two, there was really no effect on the lending side. The one thing that is pretty off limits right now are USDA loans. That's not going to affect a whole lot of people. I know within my client base, I don't work with USDA loans much.
And what are USDA loans?
So the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So if you're okay. If you're buying a piece of property, you know, if it's farm and ranch or you want to raise cattle or something more on the, plant fields of corn or what have you. So on the residential side, you don't see USDA loans pop up all that much unless they're way out in the country and they want to also raise some livestock on the land.
Right.
So those are off limits. Everything else is pretty much flowing smoothly. Now that we're into our uncharted territory in terms of the length of this shutdown, if this goes on much longer, we probably will start to see some ripple effects, especially as it relates to the IRS and verifying tax returns and those sorts of hoops that you've got to jump through as a buyer just in terms of getting your loan approval.
Hooper, are you seeing any trends emerging in this first couple weeks of 2019?
Yeah, so to maybe get back to the buyer and seller attitudes that you mentioned earlier, there's definitely an aspect of, you know, starting off a new year and kind of just what we talked about a few minutes ago, just getting back into your routines, especially with it being an election year last year. You follow up the election immediately with the holidays. So November and December were really pretty quiet, but already with the start of the new year, people are ready to get back to work. A lot of people actually, when they're setting goals or New Year's resolutions or whatever, buying a home, buying their first home is something that is on folks' lists sometimes. The activity that I've seen just in the last 10 days, there's been a significant increase over what we saw over the last
two months. So it's sort of there's like a dam, and then once January 1 hits, then that dam kind of falls, and you start to have a steady flood of people trying to get in and out of homes.
100%. And see that both on the seller side and the buyer side. So I've seen a lot of houses hit the market just in the last 10 days or so. And then similarly, a lot of buyers calling and saying, okay, hey, we're ready to go find a house now. So we should see an increase in activity both on the seller side and hopefully dealing with some of the low inventory issues that we've had over the last 2-3 years. I see that being addressed and hopefully resolved this year. And on the buyer side as well, you know, we talk every month here just about the cool factor in Waco. You know, we're still an attractive, affordable place to be, so I don't see the buyer activity slowing down at all.
Very grateful to have you on here every month for the Residential Recap, telling us what's happened in the markets. Thanks so much, Hoop.
Thank you.
I'm now joined in studio by Greg Gleim, who stops in monthly for What's Happening Here, where Greg, as our commercial real estate expert, tells us what's happening downtown, answers your questions. Greg, I got a message on Instagram on Waco Business News from someone named Chloe who said, it looks like there's a big slide coming out of a building on 500 block of Austin Avenue. This is the Bank of America building that she's talking about. You talked to the business owner, Steve Sorrells. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to see it a couple months ago as he was still in the design phase. And the elevations I saw, and I just confirmed with him, but there's going to be 40,000 feet or just over 40,000 feet of office space in that building right there. It's going to be anything from a 1,000-foot office suite up to a 40,000-foot office occupant if they came along, anywhere in between. I think he does plan on having some co-working space within that, but the elevations in the renderings on the inside were Class A, very attractive office suites in there. So I'm excited to see the finished product.
And do you think the downtown needs 40,000 square feet of office?
You know, I do. The downtown market is tough right now. What we need is 40,000 foot of higher-end jobs to come in. I think that's what we're all after. And you couldn't have a better location than what he's got there on Austin Avenue. I think that is the key to us attracting jobs. I think having the product, the real estate product like this, helps us do that. So, yeah, I don't see an issue of it filling up.
Right across from the Bank of America building on the other side of Austin has been the drive-through that used to service Bank of America customers, and there's some more parking there. Sorrells has grand plans for that block as well.
He does, and that's actually what made me or give me the opportunity to see the entire project. I was working with a hotel, and we had peeked at that site probably about 6 months ago. But ultimately, what his plan is to break it up into kind of four parcels and be able to give a hotel user one or two tracks there, with the other two tracks being made up of mixed use, either commercial retail space on the bottom and office on the second floor, or a commercial retail space on the first floor with multifamily up above. So that's a fantastic project there. It really ties in. It really looks like a downtown scene. And again, the elevations and renderings I saw on that were fantastic. I believe that across the street is phase one with the Bank of America building right now. And so later in the year, we should see him start to work on across the street as far as TIF applications and moving forward on more construction type design for that.
Are his plans going to be affecting the farmers market that sets up there? Or are they on the county side of that property and then Steve is only developing on his side?
You know, I think that's still up in the air. I know that Steve is obviously developing on his side, but I don't know whether he had gone to the county yet to discuss the expansion or not. I know that he had mentioned that back 6 months ago, but as far as the latest on that, I don't know. But, you know, again, I think in the next 6 months we may start hearing a little bit more about that.
And your 30,000-foot thoughts on another boutique hotel that's rumored to be coming to downtown Waco. Is this still something that you think we need?
You know, it is. I think as we grow entertainment attractions, as we grow office space downtown, I think we've got the demand to support it. And these unique style for Waco, I mean, it's a good product to put on the ground right now.
Greg Gleim, answering your listener questions for what's happening here, telling us about that 500 block of Austin Avenue. Greg, thank you so much for your insight.
Thanks, Austin.
I'm now joined in studio by Rebecca Eccles. Rebecca is the owner of Prefontaine, an amazing boutique that's been putting out luxury goods since 2004. They're located on Lake Air Drive. Rebecca, welcome to Downtown Depot.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your Waco history. What brought you here?
I graduated from Baylor in 2000, but then I moved to Dallas to work at a startup. When's the last time you heard the word startup? Anyway, so I worked at a startup, and then I studied English and journalism at Baylor, and I regretted not going into newspaper. And so I worked at the Korea Herald in Seoul for a while, and that was a really incredible experience. All the while, I was dating a guy in Dallas, and I thought, you know, at the end of my life, I guess I need to know that I put relationships with people before my job, which actually was a hard decision because I'm a little bit of a workaholic.
Really?
But then I came back, and so I was in Dallas, but everywhere I was applying, I mean, it was like Rhode Island and, you know, places far away. A friend of mine who was in Waco and still is, she called and said that this little specialty boutique called Très Jolie was up for sale. And I certainly, I mean, I was 25 at the time and I didn't know, I hadn't even ever balanced a checkbook, but I just, well, I never imagined, you know, being back in Waco, but I came and checked it out. And after looking through their financial sheets, which I honestly didn't even know what I was looking at, I thought, you know, maybe I can make a little money doing this. And so my dad co-signed on a loan for me and I got started.
Did you have retail aspirations before that?
Probably every female at some point entertains the idea of having a store.
You just want a big closet.
So I don't know. I had thought about it, you know, at some point, but I don't know that I ever took it seriously until the opportunity was presented.
And why take over Très Jolie? Why buy their stuff rather than, if you have an idea for a retail spot, just start your own?
Well, that's a great question. And at the end, I ended up paying them for their space and their customer list, and I ended up not buying any of their inventory.
Okay.
I mean, if I were to do that now, I certainly would just start my own thing. But, you know, back then, you don't really have resources like Google, you know, to back you up. You just are kind of in your own echo chamber. And so I thought that was the right thing to do. That's why I made that choice.
What are some of the primary differences of running a retail establishment in 2004 when you started versus today?
You know, I think that some of these differences are pretty obvious. I guess I'll speak to some things that are maybe a little more nuanced, which is that people, even say I have a customer who's been shopping with me for 15 years. And in 2004, she was just coming in, seeing what was up, and then finding something that she was looking for, maybe, you know, something that she wasn't. But now there's a hesitation in coming in. Oh, well, can you send me pictures? Oh, well, I saw this on Instagram. Or, you know, there's almost, even though there are certain customers with whom I've batted 1,000, you know, for 15 years, there's now this reliance on a visual element at all times before someone can even commit to walking in, which is, I mean, it's a little bit of a bummer. You know, it has it made it so that we have a, you know, an out-of-town, a very strong out-of-town presence, yes. But at the same time, I think there's a certain serendipity that's really fun about retail stores that is getting a little lost.
I think that as we continue to evolve, the need for experiential retail is going to be really important. We see it when you go to HEB and they do curbside delivery. That's not really an experience that people need. You don't have to go select 15 different types of lemons. You can trust that the HEB employee knows. But places like Prefontaine, where you're walking in and experiencing something that is unique that you couldn't have anywhere else, I think those are the sort of retail operations that are still going to work in the future because you are giving something special to someone.
I think that, you know, and for the younger set who has always done online shopping, I do think that there's, you know, part of that is also that they've not quite ever experienced really amazing customer service.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we not only special order for our customers, and but if our, you know, if we have a great customer and she needs something and it's at another store, we absolutely will get it for her, even though it doesn't benefit us. And, you know, I mean, it's just sort of always keeping the long game in mind, which there's just no way to translate into an online store. You know, so I really believe in what I do. I think that a couple of years ago in WWD, Women's Wear Daily, which is like an industry publication, Ralph Lauren just said that, you know, retail's not dead. And it really was during a time where these online stores were really ramping up their operations to have personal stylists, you know, that you can chat with, and these monthly delivery boxes that would come and supposedly be sort of customized to, you know, your tastes and, you know, measurements and all that. But I mean, when I send out a box every month to a customer, say, you know, at a state or whatever, I mean, it truly is. I am thinking through everything that I'm sending that customer, and, you know, it's just you can't quite replicate it. And so, although I've had several opportunities to take the store online, I just never have.
There's a little semblance of online shopping. If you go to prefontaineshop.com, you can see images of some of the clothing that you have in the store, which I think is really helpful for people to get an idea of the quality of goods and the price of goods. I mean, you have designers like Isabel Marant, Citizen, Filson. This is probably one of, if not the only place in town where you can buy retailers like this.
Yeah, it is. And I really think that our town is still small enough to that we don't really need to be overlapping brands. And I was able to start on a smaller scale, of course, 15 years ago. But, you know, the amount of resources, whether it's connections with people or financial, to start a store like mine, you'd have to be pretty committed, you know. I was pretty naive.
The price tags at Prefontaine are higher than I've seen any other retailer in town, and that's because of the quality of goods and the quality of service that you get. Is there backlash to the pricing, or do people just understand, if I'm going to Prefontaine, I know I'm going for the experience and for the quality?
Well, I've not had any, we call it price resistance is okay. The actual term, but our customers, and I'm not saying that they're just, you know, in their free time, they're just counting money, you know, it's not like that, although we have, you know, some customers with a lot of means, but they travel a lot. And so I think when you see a brand like Marant, or you see, you know, Veronica Beard or Ulla Johnson or whatever, it's the same price in New York as it is here. And and it's less, I think at my price point, it's going to be less about the dollar and more about participating in the trend. It's more about that specialty fabric. It's more about the story, you know. And so, again, I'm not saying that, you know, that all of our customers have Learjets and Lamborghinis, but I do think that if you're super price conscious, you're not really shopping with me.
Well, and I think that what's unique about your experience is that if I'm going to buy a $400 top, I don't want to buy it in New York City where I have to go get it off the rack myself. If I can do it in Waco and I can have a conversation with you and you can help me say, oh, yeah, you know, the taupe is really a better color for you than the beige. You, because of years of experience, have developed a synchronicity with your merchandise and with your customers that they can't get if they go to another store.
Yeah, I agree with that. I probably have two things to respond to that. I do believe in keeping things local as long as it's what you want. You know, I think there's sort of this pressure. But if I'm not going to buy local just because it's my obligation, if I have the opportunity, if there's something that I want and I have the opportunity to buy it in town, I'm going to do it. But I don't ever want people, and I've never wanted people to feel obligated to shop with me just because I am in town. You know, I do consider Neiman Marcus and Shopbop, you know, to be my competitors, because I mean, that is the reality of shopping now. And so anyway, so I feel really lucky that people feel a loyalty, you know, to shopping with me. But at the same time, I definitely think that I work for it.
2019 will be 15 years of Prefontaine open in Waco. You're hearing from Rebecca Eccles, shop owner. How have your customers changed in 15 years?
When I first opened, if Neiman's, if I carried a brand that Neiman's didn't, that had no credibility. You know, I think there was a the flavor at the time were big brands. And so as time has gone on, there is more of an appetite for things that are more obscure. People really like to feel as if they've discovered something. I also think, you know, as our out-of-town customer base grows, I think there is a level of discovery that people outside of Waco feel about the store.
And are these people who used to be customers when they lived in Waco and have moved, or are they Magnolia tourists who hear about Prefontaine and they want to come in? Who are these out-of-town customers?
It depends. Sometimes it's people from here that don't live here anymore, and then, oh, their friends followed us on Instagram and whatever. It's sometimes one of my great customers, her kids went to Baylor, and this was probably 10 years ago, and then she doesn't live here, but she has been an awesome customer since. I do think that even though there are endless options everywhere, I do think that human nature is to, when you find something that works, you stick with it, you know, and so I definitely try to keep that sort of inertia, you know, going with people.
What are your resources for being a better shop owner, entrepreneur, competent human? Are there podcasts you listen to, books that have been inspiring to you? Do you have a mentor?
Well, I will. I've been doing this for a while, and so when I first started, I would try to read some books. I learned QuickBooks out of the manual. It sounds so old. But I don't know. I definitely operate a little bit more on instinct, which is going to mean that I grow a lot slower and that I'm probably not going to take certain risks. But, you know, I'm also not a natural retail personality. And that's something that, you know, to the credit of our customers, they've kind of overcome. You know, because I'm not naturally very effusive, and I'm a little, you know, introverted, and kind of speak in a way that I don't think is very natural for that environment. But I think I think our customers also appreciate that I'm kind of honest, and maybe I point out details that they don't see. You know, so anyway, I don't know. I don't. You know, I'm not on like the Forbes 500, so it's not as if I'm some sort of guru,
sure.
You know, but at the same time, I think that the very derivative relationships in business is just among humans, you know, and so I know what people want and I try my best to deliver those goods, but also to kind of push them a little bit. And that's honestly just how I've operated.
How do you balance that within yourself, knowing when to push a customer towards something that's maybe a bit outside of their wheelhouse?
Well, I am rejected sometimes. But I don't know. I think that you can take risks kind of carefully. You know, for me, you know, the vast majority of designer establishments are started and run by people who didn't really need the paycheck, you know. And when I first started to buy, I would just go to Dallas, and there were all these like really nice cars and women with enormous diamond rings. And I just thought, man, people just must be making a ton of money in retail, only to find out that it was just a hobby. And not that wonderful things don't come out of that, but, you know, for lack of a better analogy, I've always kind of had a gun to my head. You know, I either sell clothes or I don't eat, you know, and certainly it's not that we have a very comfortable and wonderful life now, but you just don't really forget those days.
In 04, when you're having your dad co-sign on a loan, it was not the same financial situation as you have now.
Yeah. And and you know, the thing about what I do is that I literally don't sell anything that anyone needs. And so no matter how long I've been in business, there is always a bit of a precarious sense of, well, it's been a great run. It could really end at any second. And I know maybe it sounds silly for me to say that, but that always helps me keep my edge.
Can you point to anything growing up, maybe the way you were raised or where you were raised, friendships that you had that gave you this personality that's a little bit outside of the norm for retail, but has helped you be successful?
Well, I think the example I had growing up that gave me a very urgent and a sense of professionalism, I should say, is my dad. He's a pastor, and he always, whether he was in front of a congregation that was hundreds of people or, you know, after he retired, he had a tiny church that was 25 people. He prepared his sermons the same way. He had the program. He had a PowerPoint. He put a suit on. And that, to me, it just, over the years of seeing him do that, and he was always such a hard worker, he set a great example for me because, you know, I'm not just trying to be good for Waco or Central Texas or whatever. I'm just trying to be good. And so I feel like I have to ship as fast as Amazon Prime. I feel like I have to give, you know, better service than wherever. And that feeling never dies.
That's a great attitude, and one that I think we will see more Waco businesses adapt, that this business isn't just good in Waco. It's good anywhere. It could be dropped in Brooklyn, New York, or L.A., or Des Moines, and people would want to go shop at Prefontaine because it's special and they can have an experience there that they couldn't have otherwise. I'll get you out of here on this, Rebecca. What's 2019 looking like for Prefontaine? What are your goals for this upcoming year?
Well, we really have had a the last few years, the store has really, it's really grown. And so we're adding a couple more categories. We're going to try some kids. We've had an awesome response to our cosmetics, so we're going to go a little deeper into that. But otherwise, we're going to cruise in as we always do.
You've now got menswear, you've got cosmetics to go along with the women's fashion. And I love seeing that you have taken your approach. This is Rebecca's way of retail, and you've been sticking with it for 15 years. And it's cool to see that the community's rallied around it and that they want to support it. So thank you so much for coming on Downtown Depot and telling a little bit of your story.
Oh, I love it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Rebecca Eccles, Austin Hooper, Greg Gleim, and you for tuning in. If you haven't already subscribed to the Waco Business Newsletter, visit our website to get on the mailing list. Downtown Depot airs on KWBU on first and third Fridays of the month, but as you know, the news never stops. So on Fridays in between shows, I send out a free newsletter with links to all the recent buzz, as well as any articles I find particularly interesting on topics like city planning and community building. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. We'll be right back.